What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Deputy Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
This week, we've got reviews for the Pixel 9 and 9 Pro and XLs and all the various Pixel 9 models, except for the Fold. That's not out yet, so that's very sad. That's going to be a couple of weeks away. And we've also got some news from Gamescom 2024, which is, I guess, still happening, but most of the major news has already happened from the opening night and some follow-up events. And got some weekly news as well. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes and drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. And join us Thursdays, typically around 10:45 a.m. Eastern on our YouTube channel, where we live stream the show and you can talk to us. We'll show off some gadgets. I know Sherlyn has something she wants to show off soon during our Q&As. And it's a fun time. We've also got a good group of people here. So join us. We've got the Pixel phones now, Sherlyn. I'm sure you've been like in editing hell for the past week. Can you broadly tell us, so how do we feel about the, let's focus on the Pixel 9 right now. How do we feel about the All Pixel right. 9? Yeah.
The Pixel 9, I wasn't expecting it to get a super high score, but yeah. Sam, who reviewed the Pixel 9 for us, seems really impressed. I mean, like, look.
Sam likes it. Sam Rutherford, senior writer.
Sam Rutherford is our, like, Android main person. And he is also our photables person. So having him review like the most standard Pixel 9, I was just like, he's going to be bored, right? I was like, this man's used to his big foldable screens. But Sam really enjoyed the Pixel 9. And like to contextualize it for everyone, I went from reading Matt's review first of the Pixel 9 Pro and Pro XL. So Matt Smith, our UK bureau chief. I went from editing him and then going on to Sam, whose review went up the next day. And, like, again, you read the Pro review, you're like, of course it's good. Of course everyone liked the Pro.
Matt scored the Pro very, very high. Like, that is surprising.
Well, let's get to that. I wanted to talk about that. But, you asked to start with the 9, so we'll start with the 9, the basic.
Well, if you feel more interested in the Pro, you can start there. It's up to you.
We can. I've just started talking about the 9. Let's finish this thought. So after I went from, like, Matt to Sam, I wish this was the Pro, you know, kind of that vibe. I didn't get that. I actually got Sam going, like, at the end, he said, like, truly, if you don't need the Gemini Advanced AI, if you don't need, like, a telephoto, like, a dedicated telephoto camera, you may even be very happy with the Pixel 9, which is, like, again, what we always differentiate between the Pro and the regular flagships is that,
it's the iPhone and iPhone Pro situation too, right?
Like exactly. It's the same situation now. So I think it used to be, though, in previous years, that because there was never a smaller Pixel Pro, it was always like a larger, the Pixel Pro was always a larger phone, we had more reason to recommend the 9 because of size.
Sure.
But now it's like, no, even if there is like an alternative size in the premium, like premium top end, like sort of variant, we still are like, the 9's pretty freaking good. So I was just surprised by that. Now, back to your point, the more interesting review, in my opinion, is the fact that Matt decided to award the Pixel 9 Pro and 9 Pro XL respectively, like, really high scores for any Android handset ever for us.
Yeah.
94 and 92 is where we landed with the 9 Pro and 9 Pro XL respectively. And again, to contextualize and give you all like a little bit of behind the scenes, he scored them a little bit higher at first. And I was like, whoa.
We're not going to have a 100 out of 100, Matt.
Yeah. I just was like, I think we might need to tamper this a little bit. Like, I feel like we're very excited, but we need to give ourselves a little bit of wiggle room. Like, what are they? They're not perfect, right? So I think we tweaked, and in the tweaking, we tweaked the original scores for both devices. Both went down a little bit. I think if you look at our score for last year's Pixel 8 Pro, it was 93. And again, this is like way too in the weeds. And both Matt and I will be like, we hate arguing over like 1 or 2 points. But here's the reasoning. 93 for last year's, and usually we're like, this is just as good, if not better. So maybe we'll go to 93 or 91. But then we brought the Pixel 9 Pro XL down a point, and that is in part because Matt still wanted to have like a big enough gap between the 9 Pro and the 9 Pro XL.
Fair.
And so 93 just wasn't giving us a lot of room. And then the other reason is that the 9 Pro XL actually, even though it is the same size, its screen is 0.1 an inch bigger this year, which like doesn't sound like much when you're talking about a frame that's still the same size. But the screen for Matt, who boldly claimed he had larger than average hands or average or whatever, not too small hands. I don't know what he's telling us there, but he was all like, it was
big
already
humble
hard
brag.
For him to
Thank
reach.
You, Matt.
It was a very humble brag, but even for Matt, it was like hard to reach the corners. And so with that, we were like, all right, it's worth like saying it is unwieldy. It is a more expensive phone than last year. These AI features don't do enough for us to be like, yeah, it's worth that, you know, keeping its same score sort of situation yet. So we brought it down a point, but that's not a bad thing because why? The Pixel 9 Pro, holy crap. We like, it's arguably one of our highest scored phones around like 94. So obviously you've read these reviews, Devendra. Like, were you shocked at the scores we gave?
I was shocked at the score of the 9 Pro. The XL, you know, being a little more unwieldy, I was not surprised there. But it does seem like, I don't know, I was talking about this with Sam a little bit too, like around his review. It is funny to see Google's journey on like the way it's thinking of Android phones, right? Because they launched with, let's go back in history, right? They launched with like the HTC G1, right? And some of the like early Motorola's, like stuff from third parties. Then third parties started making a lot of garbage and putting a lot of stuff into Android software. So Google was like, okay, hold up. Let's have these Nexus phones, which are just pure Android, which run all our stuff and doesn't have any of your third-party garbage. And at that point, that was never a big seller, right? That was for the fans, the super fans, the people online, the super nerds. Pixel was their attempt to be like, okay, let's screw it. Let's just go iPhone. And I feel like 9 generations in, they finally done it. The camera bar has been chopped up. The design looks a little spiffier. I'm not too surprised. I do feel like it seems like Google like knocked this one out. So I was shocked by the scored number, but yeah, I feel like Google, it's been a long road for Google to get to this point to make like the ideal Android phone, I'd say.
It has. And I mean, I don't know if I would call it the ideal Android phone, even if I think it is a very significantly improved device over, let's say, the earlier Pixels, even though it feels like over the Pixel 8, which I also like have here, right? And for those of you on the stream, I'm holding it up side by side so you can kind of look, right? The design felt nice on the Pixel 8 Pro, you know, the colors, you know, Google's always nailed the color combo. It feels very different. This time, I think you've seen all our reviews mention this independently, Matt Smith in the UK and Sam in New Jersey were both all like, this feels like an iPhone. Matt almost like picked it up and was like, this
it looks
like
the an
iPhone.
iPhone.
And it looks like an iPhone. That's not a bad thing, right? Because like they still have enough of a distinction. Like the camera bar is different enough. There's the G logo, I guess. That's a good thing in the sense that it feels premium, it feels solid, it feels like a good real phone. And I'm sure there are people who won't be happy about that. They're like, you know, don't keep copying Apple. All phones are so boring now, they're all the same. Because don't forget the Samsung S24 series also feel like iPhones. I've got an Samsung S24 in hand as well, and it's like they've all become more or less the same. And whether it's a good or bad thing is really up to you to decide. But for Google, though, the design is a huge step up, right? Like, they don't feel the need to differentiate. They don't feel the need to do these, like, incredibly, like, slimmy, curvy sides anymore to achieve a slightly thinner profile. It feels very grown up. And I wrote a blurb for our best smartphones guide about the Pixel 9 Pro saying that this feels like a grown-up phone. And to Matt's point in his review, a showcase for Gemini AI. And I think that that's what these phones are all about. Pixel phones have always been about the camera, but like these are like camera but plus, you know?
Are we liking the AI features? And we should also differentiate between the local stuff, which you don't have to pay for, and then there's the fancier stuff, which comes free with the Pro devices for a year, but you will have to pay for that eventually, at least $20 a month. Is the AI stuff any good?
I mean, the capability and the like actual good of it, like the how well it works, right? Seems like pretty good. I mean, like, add me, everyone's been having fun with, like, again, independently, right, both right. Sam and Matt were like, we use add me to clone ourselves. And add me, to be clear, is the feature on the camera where you can have you know, you're taking a group shot and then you can hand, someone takes the photo first and then hand the phone off to someone else. And then you, the photographer, can go and take your place in the picture. And the phone will give some AR guidance to show you where to, you know, frame up the shot and to make you in the picture. So that seemed impressive enough and fun enough that they both were like playing around with it. Because it's only been, what, like a week since these phones were launched, it's not enough time to say how much we'll use this in the real world. Things like the Pixel Screenshots app, I think there are problems here and there where like Sam enjoyed it. Sam really found it useful. Yeah. Matt had issues with it. Like he points out that like you can't automatically back up your entire Google Photos history on setup. So it'd be like you will have to manually import pictures one by one. And it's just not, there's nothing wrong with like manually importing pictures. And this is a huge privacy thing because some people's like,
yeah, it's definitely a privacy thing.
Yeah. It's like Google Photos. Mine is like so many years in history and I don't want to like, give it access to everything at once. So anyway, there's also the Pixel Studio app, which I think both of Sam and Matt liked because it was fun, but both of them were also like, eh. Like, I think this is more of a criticism of image generators like that in general, where like you feed Midjourney a prompt and it comes up, how much are you going to use that? We're not really going to do that all day. It's not that much useful. So those are the main AI features. I mean, the rest of the stuff, like your typical Gmail summary things or like your, even Apple Intelligence is trying to do some of these things. I didn't get a real big sense that they were that in, like crazy good. I mean, Sam mentioned call notes in his piece, but I think none of us have really like put it through the ringer through like really difficult calls to see if it works through all those situations as well. So,
and that's the thing that will like summarize your call and like give you notes, like the thing in text. That's cool.
Yeah. A transcript and a summary, which is cool. Mm-hmm. I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. So, but I mean, overall, I guess any surprising highlights from the Userland or any like surprising disappointments?
Zoom enhance on videos is a weird, like it took them 1 year to actually bring it out to a device.
Yes.
And then the fact that it's not on the 9, you have to have a 9 Pro to use it, was what Sam pointed out in the 9, which is, you know, I would expect that from Sam, right? Who's used to reviewing Pro phones. And then for Matt, I think they both pointed out in low light, Google's cameras still far and away better than the competition. They both meticulously put it through his paces in the camera front. I think we all really enjoy camera testing. And it still came up tops, right? Google still came up tops on camera. And Matt, our review almost didn't get up on time because he had to run the battery test for the Pixel 9 Pro and Pro XL. Well, the Pro arrived a little later than the Pro XL did, so he didn't have as much time. But also, the Pro ran for so long. It lasted 25 hours on our battery test. That's a lot. I mean, the Pro XL got 23 hours thereabouts. Wait, that's already like longer. The 25 hour mark is longer than our next closest number, which is the OnePlus 12, I believe. So all around, just incredibly impressive phones. I'm surprised. And I think that that's what's surprising, right? Like, we're like, whoa, these are good? What?
These are good? Well, I there were a lot of shocks early on. It's like, these are stylish. These seem capable and good. Like, I know, like, I think that's going to be a big compelling factor for a lot of people, Sherlyn. Like, Google for a long time has been like, we're making phones for nerds and for people who don't care as much about Samsung bling and whatever. And now it's just like, no, Google's like, no, we're just gonna do the same thing. We're gonna do iPhone type stuff. How does this compare to the current Samsung stuff, Sherlyn?
I mean, I think Google has the upper hand in AI for sure and cameras. So I think that's what I was seeing across the board, that like the S24's cameras were good, but in some situations not as good. Although in one occasion, like Samsung did better on the Pro XL or something. And then I want to address some of the questions in the chat really quickly. So MiniMe1231 asks if we will be comparing the Google AI versus the Apple AI. Obviously, we can't right now because the Apple Intelligence stuff isn't out. We could compare Samsung's, to your point, Devendra, Samsung's Galaxy AI to Google's Gemini AI. But like I said, it's just like different applications, different things. Like Samsung's AI, Galaxy AI feature in the Z Flip 6 and the Z Fold 6, which are its latest to feature like new Galaxy AI features, came with like you can draw onto a picture and it'll like add a cat. Yes. You know,
yeah,
that sort of thing to me is really fun, but like the actual use of it, IDK, right? Meanwhile, Google's like got no equivalent feature. It's got AutoFrame and Reimagine, and it's got like Pixel Studio. And so there's no easy way to do an apples to apples comparison. But I also want to address that CUD or CUD, who is a familiar name from our chat, says that whole add me feature, is this something that people want? Because it's a bit weird if it becomes the norm. People would just be adding in all their friends and family and photos when they were never there. Might as well add your cat and dog while you're at it. I don't think you can, after the fact, add people, FYI. So like for add me, it's like you're holding up the phone. And then, for example, I've had family visiting this past couple weeks or so. And if I'm sounding ragged, that's why. And we've been taking like family pictures, right? Like, so it's four of us and we are trying not to like bother people. So we don't ask strangers. Also, you don't always feel safe, right? When you're on the street and like standing in front of a museum and like, take a photo for four of us, please. Who's to say they won't just run? So I could have my cousin, you know, hold up the phone and take the initial picture while I pose with his mom and dad. And then he comes into the picture. I hold up the phone and I think if there are a lot of specific use cases where it'll be helpful. And I don't think you can add a cat and dog in because you'll never get the cat and dog to stay in the place they need them to. So CD cut, I am sorry, but I don't think you can. And I think I would, I could see some use for this add me feature.
I'm sure people will figure out ways to like hack it, but it does seem from the demos they did, like it creates like an AR situation of where you are right
like
now.
Like an outline.
Break that environment, like where it is, like I don't think you can actually even stitch something into that. I think the bigger issue is just like it is weird to have some features locked into just Google's phones when Google is both, you know, a company making phones but also the company providing the software to everybody else. This is very much like Internet Explorer on Windows, you know, or Apple locking down some features just to its devices. Like it feels like if this goes on, people can shout monopoly or something going on here. Do you feel weird about that, Trillin? Like some of these just being on Google stuff for so far?
I don't know that they're going to always be that way. I think that like for some things, because Gemini Advance is something that you can apply for and get with any other like phone, right? Like you can apply for, and so some of these features might come out to future Android phones or other branded Android phones. And then with Pixel, there have been a few things that have been locked into Pixel for a very long time, like Pixel UI things, Pixel's call screening, Pixel's like general like call assistance things have been very Pixel phone centric. And I feel like that's because it's built so deeply into the OS as opposed to like it's an app, right? The Pixel Screenshots app, Pixel Recorder, those things have eventually opened up to some other, maybe Samsung, maybe like, I don't even think there's other Android players out there really, but Samsung, right? And they work closely enough with Samsung to be like, eventually maybe, right? Circle to Search is a feature that launched first on Samsung, even though it was a Google feature. So I feel like it's not necessarily super locked in. And even if it were, to answer that part of your question, I don't know if that is such a huge deal. I think maybe Google does need to keep some of this for itself, right? Like we know that Android is supposed to be like the most open ecosystem. It's supposed to be like welcoming and like whatever. But Google at this point needs to be able to play the game the way Samsung, Apple, especially Apple,
does
have been playing it.
Though it's inherently unfair to be both the software vendor doing it and also be like, oh, also, hey, partners, we're also going to directly compete with you in hardware and also keep features to ourselves that you can never touch. Like that,
absolutely.
That is where anti-competitive stuff like starts to arise, I guess. Yeah.
I mean, I think Google has its feet and toes in so many like things that like it's anti-competitive in a lot of other areas. But I think on
absolutely.
The Pixel front, like it's generally been trying to bring Pixel first or Pixel only features to more devices. But then like, you know, when you said the whole like, oh, you're talking about the software and the hardware, I was like at first really readying to reply being like Apple does that. But then you were saying that it's not fair because Google competes with its own customers. So like, I get that. I don't know. I don't know that like, I don't know how they're going about it really.
The U.S. government has declared them a monopoly, right? Or at
antitrust.
Least the U.S. judge has. Antitrust. So search there. They are a search monopoly. Android is such a open ecosystem that everybody supports. Like, I just feel like Google is going to start to be worried about this because we already talked about the potential repercussions from the search monopoly thing. Like, could be like, hey, maybe you should split up a little bit. Maybe we should take out some of these parts of Google and make them separate companies. And I wonder if the company itself is a little afraid of that because it's not just like, oh, we're going to slap a $5 or $10 million fine on you, which is like the money Google, you know, that it's in their couch cushions.
Yeah.
It's like more serious things could happen. Yeah.
Can I quickly go back to the chat for specific to Pixel questions too? The Pixel 9, I mean. So has Sam, maybe Sam in an alternate timeline, is like, would love to hear about the heat management of the Tensor 4. And this is something that did come up in our Pixel 9 Pro review. So Matt noticed that the Tensor G4 actually runs a lot cooler than older Pixel phones. So like... Sorry, it's very weird to be like, the Tensor G4 runs cooler than the Pixel 8 Pro, because like, where else is the Tensor G3 going to be? Obviously the Pixel 8 Pro. But I think it's important to focus on the phone than just the chip, because even though the chip does supposedly run cooler, it's also the fact that, like, to DPro9's point in the chat, Pixel 9 series has a better like thermal dissipation system. So like it's a lot cooler. I did notice that, yes, the Pixel 8 Pro that I was using would run really hot. I haven't, I think, pushed the 9 Pro XL enough to feel like it would in, you know, that circumstance otherwise be hot. But I've never felt it run hot, right? So like to that point, it certainly seems to run cooler. Matt definitely pushed it harder in his review and was like, it was cooler. So Hassam, I hope that answers your question. And I mean, I think the fact that the phone's a little bit thicker of a profile is partly because it needed to build in some sort of like better cooling system. So, yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, any other thoughts on these things? I would want to point people to our reviews. Go check them out on the site.
Go check out our site. Pixel 9 Pro reviews been up since yesterday, and our Pixel 9 reviews up today. The on sale date for that series of phones is up today. And then we have so many other Pixel devices coming in. Send me your questions about them. What do you want to know most about the 9 Pro Fold, the Pixel Watch 3, and the Pixel Buds Pro 2? Last week, also on Saturday, I did a quick Engadget review recap, and I will be doing one of these for the Pixel products at some point. So again, I really want to know your thoughts on the upcoming devices before we review them, so that I can go into them looking for those questions. So send them our way, podcast@engadget.com. You can always email me, chr@engadget.com as well.
Let's move on to some news from Gamescom 2024, which is happening right now in Cologne, Germany. We are not there in person, I believe, but we're covering a lot of news from the event and some highlights here. And joining us for this discussion is our podcast producer, Ben Ellman. Hey, Ben.
Because when we're talking about video games, it's Ben time.
It's Ben time. And we don't want to break Sherlyn's brain with some of this game stuff, because I'm sure Sherlyn does not care about the Indiana Jones game coming to Xbox. I don't know.
Do you, Sherlyn? I have heard that young Indiana Jones.
What?
Who was the actor? Shit.
What? You mean Shia LaBeouf?
You mean River Phoenix? No.
Young, what's his face? Young. What? Crap. This older man.
Okay, this is why young Harrison Ford?
Harrison Ford. Young Harrison Ford.
This is why Ben is on the segment. This is why Ben is helping us out while we talk about this.
Anyway, I've heard that young Harrison Ford is hot. Anyway, that's all. Go for it.
It doesn't look like Harrison Ford. It's a totally different.
I know. I'm just saying that when I hear model. Indiana Jones, I think.
Okay, Harrison so Sherlyn is talking about the CG version of young Harrison Ford.
No, not CG. I've been sent pictures of him on his heyday.
AI. Okay. Well, yes, he was hot. Yes, but also in the most recent movie, they used AI to de-age him.
Yikes.
You get a glimpse of that old hot Harrison Ford face. Anyway, we're talking about the game here. This game is one of the rare exclusives that Microsoft has. And there was a lot of talk about this thing. This is Indiana Jones and the Great Circle. It's coming from, it's developed by Xbox's subsidiary Machine Games. I believe this came as part of the whole ZeniMax acquisition. So when Microsoft bought id Software, Arkane, Bethesda, Machine Games came alongside that. And I believe there was a deal to get this game to Sony's eventually. So here's what we learned, is that this game is coming to Xbox and PC on December 9th. It's coming to the PlayStation 5 a couple months later, in spring 2025. And the nerds, especially the Microsoft nerds, the Xbox fans, have gone a little crazy, because they're like, our exclusive! What's happening now? Do you have thoughts about this, Sherlyn or Ben?
This is Microsoft admitting that not very many people have Xboxes, and they don't want this to just be a PC game.
Microsoft is a business, and they like to sell games, and unfortunately their hardware has not done a good job with that. So I think that's the basic thing here. Does this feel odd to you, Sherlyn, or is this just weird fanboy inviting at this point?
I always think of it as strange fanboy infighting because I don't pay attention as much to this news. Doesn't really matter to me.
It's funny, like when you tune, like, what are the gamers up to? They're mad about Indiana Jones. They're mad about this lady character starring in a game. Yeah. The gamers are not okay. Yeah.
Every now and then there's like this big controversy in gaming, right? Like, what, trans characters, sexism, violence. There's always kind of public outcry over a lot of these things. I think I'm more concerned when it's like when Blizzard, Activision, and all that stuff, right? Sexism at the workplace, toxic environment, like that sort of
we'll talk about that soon.
Even more harm.
We'll get to that
soon. Don't worry, we've got that. So anyway, if you
Great. I was looking forward to it. Awesome.
there is news here.
Okay, so Devendra, one of my big questions was, you know, as I was watching the trailer for this game and reading Jess's first look.
The game, which looks sick as hell, by the way. I do think this game looks fantastic.
Yeah, so I was wondering, okay, with the Uncharted series and everything, like, why isn't this a third-person game? But then after, like, watching the trailer, I realized, okay, I think they want to make it really visceral. Like, there's a lot of hand-to-hand combat in this game. They want to make it feel like the movies did. The fight choreography in the Indiana Jones movies back then, just fight choreography overall was okay.
Punch, punch, fine. Yeah.
And Indiana Jones was never known for like huge like martial arts maneuvers like Batman or anything.
Oh no, he's known for shooting the guy swinging the sword.
Yeah, exactly. You know? So you can't really have like an Arkham Asylum, you know, third person style like Indiana Jones game where Indy is like breaking a Nazi's back over his knee.
They could have done some. I honestly prefer third person like angles like games too, because I like to see my characters when I'm running around. But I think that mostly this comes from machine games, right? And machine games, they did those the Wolfenstein, the most recent like Wolfenstein games, which are fantastic and good. And also, I did not really care to play like a modern Wolfenstein shooter, but they did great stuff when it came to like environmental storytelling, good writing. They did some interesting stuff with first person shooters, so. I think it's just an interesting choice to do this. I think the camera pans out sometimes, so you do see the character, and in cutscenes you see him too. We'll see how this goes. Go read Jess Condit's hands-on with this thing. The title is Indiana Jones and the Great Circle has a Nazi slapping mechanic, and that's
gotta
just
love
good
it.
To see. Gotta love it. Shout out to this game for doing that. Also, in Microsoft news, there's a couple assistive tech things that they announced. There's a new Xbox Adaptive Joystick, which is a single stick type of thing, which looks like, honestly, it looks a lot like a VR controller, like something with the Oculus headset or something. But you can plug this into an existing Xbox controller, the Adaptive controller, and gives you a bunch of controls that you can handle with just one hand. Let me see here. There are also some 3D printable files for Daptic thumbstick toppers. So you can download these files. They're free. You have to get access to the 3D printer. Talk to your local library because often they will have some of these devices. But you can print out these things to get like better grips on your phone too for people who have trouble with you know very typical gripping. There's also this cool thing. Let me see here. In partnership with 8BitDo, that controller company, there's the Lite SE 2.4G wireless controller, which is a gamepad with all the inputs on the top, has low resistance buttons and Hall Effect joysticks. It also has those like giant 8BitDo the super buttons that they put on their mechanical keyboards, just like a big ass button you can hit and I guess program things too. So a lot of interesting options here too.
I'm seeing CUD in the chat saying that it looks like a Wii nunchuck. That is not wrong.
It is not wrong, but it, more specifically, if Microsoft were to be like, hey, maybe we should do a VR headset or something, this kind of looks like what a VR controller looks like, maybe without the motion controls. So that is cool. Also, the all-digital Xbox Series X, which we thought was kind of a joke when Microsoft announced it a couple months ago, you can pre-order that now. It's $450. It's going to be coming to the U.S. on October 15th. It's only $50 cheaper than the disc version. That disc version, which, by the way, often goes on sale for $400, sometimes even less. So I'm still a little baffled by this thing. I'm even more baffled by the $600 special edition, which has a 2 TB drive and the disc drive, but it's $600? I don't know.
And we were just talking about how Xbox is only doing okay.
They're only doing so rather than like lowering the prices to ship more boxes, they're like, I don't know, man. People like us. We'd rather sell more games through Sony than make our boxes cheaper. So a really interesting calculation Microsoft is making there. Sherlyn, did you ever decide on an Xbox? Did you ever get the Series S? Because we've talked about that for a couple of years.
Never, baby. Never. I'm going to get a PS5 Pro or whatever.
Never. That was a good time to avoid that, but I don't know, more Steam Deck stuff for you or those PC handhelds. I know you've been playing around with those.
Yeah, I think that actually the PC handhelds are probably the best option for Sherlyn.
As they get smaller, too, because they're still big and
yeah, smaller
right
is
now.
Better. They're a bit big and heavy right now. I mean, I played a lot with I played a little bit with the Steam Deck. And my Switch is still a beautiful ornament behind my
You can honestly play most of the like good indie games right now on Switch, so you're not missing out.
Mine's
on much.
A pretty yeah. old Switch. Got it like right before the pandemic, so
oh
I
yeah,
don't know.
Me too.
But you probably had the updated yeah. battery at least if that was 2020.
Yeah, yeah, better battery for sure. I had that. So you're good. I mean, I think I'm interested in these games. I like the handheld games, but like my habits have changed so much over the last 2 years. It's like, oh, I got into crocheting a lot. Oh, now I just sit around drawing. So
you got into Vampire Survivors on your phone, right? And that made you a little crazy. Did. So I think you could do that on Switch.
I am a beast at Vampire Survivors. I don't know what y'all talking about. I'm a gamer.
You're a total gamer. Borderlands 4 is coming, which feels like a threat. Gearbox and 2K Games announced that it's coming in 2025, which I think the impact of this announcement would have been maybe they were planning for the movie to go a little better. Maybe they were being like, oh yeah, people are hyped for Borderlands right now. Let's announce our next game. No, everybody hates the Borderlands movie. I called it a disaster. It's a huge mess. So I don't know who's excited for this thing, but hopefully it's better than Borderlands 3, which I recall being a little disappointing.
In retrospect, could we have said that the Borderlands movie was not going to be that great when we saw that Kevin Hart was cast in it?
But he's not the problem. He's not the problem in that movie. The problem is that, the script is bad. A lot of things are bad in that movie.
So talking specifically about Borderlands 4, I just wish that I had more of a squad to play it with, because I have been playing like Borderlands 1 and 2. I got those on sale as part of a kind of like buy the whole collection deal a couple of years ago. And I was having a good time playing it by myself, but I was like, I feel like I need more people. And like when I started playing this was a time kind of like I had taken a sabbatical from like online kind of squad-based games. And now that I have been playing Helldivers so much, I've got like 125 hours in on there.
God damn it. Yeah.
Yeah. Now I'm thinking, okay, yeah, I really want to like find a squad of people to like do other like squad-based games with.
I mean, you've got a lot of options, Sam. You've got all the other sorts of like Valorant and whatnot. So I don't know. There's so many squad-based games right now. This is, I do wonder, like, wouldn't the actual, like, evolution of Borderlands be like, let's do a Destiny type of thing where you're actually going on, you know, multiplayer missions and stuff with people? I think because you could do co-op play and just, like, dick around in Borderlands, but it was never as robust as something like Destiny. So I don't know. That could be the thing. Did you see the story, Ben and Sherlyn, about the NVIDIA Ace Virtual Humans? Those are coming.
I got a
games.
Lot to say about this, but go
a lot
on.
To say. These are so last year, I believe, NVIDIA showed off its Avatar Cloud Engine technology, ACE technology that's powering characters in some games. So basically, creating NPCs that will react to you the way like ChatGPT does, so that they would speak if you ask them a question or if you choose a certain prompt or something, they could like react to what you're saying or maybe react to your clothing, but also their model will like look like it's talking properly. They will like have a semi AI conversation. A lot of people were criticizing this as a way to like be like, this means you don't need as many writers, right? This means you could just populate your games with this weird AI spouting avatars and not actually write dialogue for them or storylines or anything. That's the controversy. The news is that it's actually coming to a multiplayer mecha game called Mecha Break. I've not heard too much about this game, but it is actually happening. It's totally real. What did you think about this news, Ben?
I watched the video where, you know, you're basically in kind of like a cyberpunk-esque world, and like you're going into a sushi shop and you're talking with the like sushi shop owner. And I think it's cool that you can use your voice to interact with this AI character. I think that that's a really cool like method of input and something that's probably going to pop up in a lot more games. But when the character started talking, it felt very wooden. It felt like you were talking to a robot. The voice didn't have very much color to it. And hey, I'm a voice guy, so...
Oh, you can tell.
Really, yeah, I really want that to feel more alive. And so I was thinking, how would we end up using this technology? Because I think that it could be useful in some cases, but definitely not as the main player character. Definitely not as, you know, the next rung of NPCs.
Yeah, important. These are like NPCs and weird submissions off at the end of the map or something.
Yeah, give them should dialogue. Probably, yeah. Like the most important, you know, five or so NPCs should probably still be written and acted. But where this could end up being really useful is if you have like a big open world game. I'm thinking about like Assassin's Creed or something where you're like always running through these like crowded marketplaces or something, and you just hear people like yelling things, that if you have a couple of people doing background acting like lines and then the rest of it generated by NVIDIA Ace, then that could be a good way of like stretching your budget a little bit further and making the overall world feel a bit more alive.
Yeah, yeah. You are absolutely right, Ben. That's, I'm sure, what they're all thinking. I hate that idea because especially like when I was playing the latest like Assassin's Creed game, which is set way back in like, I don't know, it's in the Middle East thousands of years ago, and walking through the towns, like walking through the villages and seeing the way they constructed it and seeing like people interact with dialogue that has been recorded by humans and written by humans, like it felt like so alive. I was kind of astounded by that. And if you replace that ambience with AI stuff, you know, like that to me will kill the realism of the game. And I'll just feel like I'm just walking through the simulation right now. I'm not walking through ancient Baghdad or anything. Right. I feel like that'll kill it more. So I'm sure you all have thoughts. Podcast@engadget.com. Listen to what you think about this. I'm not a huge fan. Not a huge fan of like...
I just hope it doesn't kill the art of the like little in-joke kind of world-building thing. One of my favorites from Mass Effect was there was that one race of aliens that felt like it needed to... Or like in order to communicate with other species, it needed to preface the emotion that it was putting into its sentence.
Say it in words. It's amazing.
Yeah,
love it,
and then...
Love it.
Like when you're in an elevator or something, there's a little ad for a all that alien species production of like Hamlet or something.
Yeah.
So that's very funny. And if we lost that, I would feel like we're losing so much from like, I don't know, quirky little world building things in video games.
Quirky little things. I mean, that's just good writing. That's human ingenuity and creativity. There is maybe something interesting that'll happen with like, hey, emergent AI as avatars. That is like, we love like game systems. You see what people do with like just the systems in Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom, or think back to Far Cry 2, where people are just like having a lot of fun with the rules and the mechanics of that world. I'm sure it's going to lead to some of that stuff. I'm just worried that some of these companies will over-rely on all of it. Let's move on to Black Myth Wukong, though, which is a game that is totally killing it. Sherlyn, I feel like this may be up your alley, too, because this is a Journey to the West game, basically. It's sort of like an adaptation.
I mean, I love the idea. Is it a fighting game? Do you, like, fight?
It is very much. It's like a Dark Souls game. It's like God of War.
Okay, but it isn't actually a Souls-like game. That's the thing.
It isn't.
It looks like a Souls-like game, but it isn't.
It has the mechanics. It has the healing. It has the crazy-ass bosses. Like, what I'm saying is it is very much God of War, the sort of, like, adventuring around, not as open as like the way Elden Ring was, but very like in specific spaces, it feels like Dark Souls. It feels like actually playing early Dark Souls, but also with the big ass bosses from Elden Ring and even God of War, the newer games ended up doing a lot of that. So that's what this game is.
In trying to get myself up to speed on this game, I was watching a lot of videos, watching some streamers and stuff. And the thing that I saw from so many of the YouTube videos is saying that this isn't a Souls-like game. And then when I watched actual gameplay, it showed, you know, big bosses, like when you hit a boss or when you hit one of these like larger enemies, all you're doing is chip damage, and like the fights are pretty long, which makes me feel like it is kind of more Souls-like than not. I don't understand.
It is more Souls-like than it isn't. I think some people are being weird and precious because gamers are weird. But no, you have to walk around and light like lanterns, and this is where you respawn when you die. The big thing is you don't lose all your stuff. You don't lose all your experience and your items when you die, so you can just go back and keep hammering at a boss, which is something you cannot do in a Souls game very easily. I guess it's more like when you're exploring somewhere and you die from some stupid enemy and you lose like a lot of good experience. That's the stuff that breaks my heart. That just doesn't happen in this game. You can explore and do whatever. Anyway, the news is that it was released this week and it broke Steam's concurrent single player record launch within hours of its launch. So that is an insane thing for it to happen. I think the numbers we saw,
not so much of an asterisk though, the concurrent players, so many of them were in China. Like this,
I was
is
going to ask where
people
they
being
were
really enthusiastic about it in China, and then like a small minority of people, like single digit percentage of people in the US were playing this game.
Mm-hmm. What's up, Sean?
And they were all Chinese too.
Probably. Well, a lot of people were interested in this
Chinese
game.
People in Asia, in America. I'm not surprised by the numbers. I think the Wukong title is interesting. Like, I wanted to ask you about, like, you know, because y'all both delve into the similarities to Dark Souls and, like, talk about the mechanics a lot and the, like, components of the story. But, like, I'm like, are the story characters that I like from growing up, are they there? You know, like, are does the Monkey King fall in love with the spider demon? Does, like, does he,
I don't,
does
not,
his
I've
ring
only played
around his head
so
get
far
tighter?
Yeah.
I know. So that's what I would be curious to see, if they've, like, faithfully adapted the sort of story things that me, and I'm sure those concurrent streamers who are hugely Chinese, are looking for. That's the sort of, like, vibe we're looking for, maybe.
You play as the Monkey King, so I'll give you that. You got the staff, you got the cloud he flies on. What is funny though is that I started watching OG Dragon Ball with my daughter, and she is very much into original Dragon Ball. I'm like, look, Monkey King, there's the staff, there's
right,
his cloud. He's
so
he has
here's
a tail.
My thing too. Yeah. There have been a lot of, like, not that I'm not talking about, like, specifically Dragon Ball, but there have been, like, a lot of other adaptations, maybe even Western adaptations of the Monkey King story that don't feel as faithful. Like, I remember Monkey King appearing somewhere as, like, a playable character, or, like, in some other, like, smaller movie type thing as a baddie or something, right? And I'm just like, that's not what the Monkey King story is. It's a story about redemption. And
it's about redemption, yeah. And the wily monkey. So, anyway, I just want to point out that crazy numbers from the game. What we were saying is 88% of the players were in China. So US was at a
3%. What a nice coincidence. We love the number 8.
I was wondering about
yes.
that. Like,
very
how
lucky.
Is it that it was 88%?
Very lucky.
Like that just seems like the books were cooked.
We gamed it, y'all.
I'm
that's
not,
all. That's all.
Let's be clear. I am not accusing them of cooking the books on this, but it just seems like a really interesting coincidence.
Well, let me put the context down here. So this is essentially China's first AAA game, the first like game that is on the level of something like God of War.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm pretty sure if the government
was probably well adapted, yeah.
If the government was like, we really got to get the numbers on this game, like what can we do?
Gaming consoles.
Those consoles that are turned off because of gaming lockdown time, the government's like, yes, please all off. You all get free copies of the game. I don't know. No, we don't know
the 88
if
number
they
were like, we're good, we're done.
I think a lot of people in China definitely wanted to play this game. I'm playing through it right now. A couple of things worth mentioning, because the developer Game Science was like in the news too, because apparently there was a document that went out to some streamers, or not streamers, but people who were
like got the first look at the game or something.
The people who were covering the game, mainly in China, but apparently this went out to other countries, like a couple of other European countries too. There was a list of forbidden subjects in their review agreement, which include do not mention politics, do not mention feminist propaganda, do not mention COVID-19 or China's video game industry policies, the stuff we're talking about right now, and other content that instigates negative discourse. Also, I believe like violence was one thing, even though this is a game about the Monkey King, like bashing giant gods in their heads with his stick. Just kind of funny. There is that whole thing. Game Science did not respond to an email. I'm looking at the New York Times reporting here. But this is not too surprising. Right, because we deal with all sorts of limitations when it comes to when we cover games. It's mainly just like it's an embargo. Like, hey, please don't spoil all the storylines. That's just like an agreement to like not spoil all the big surprises in the game. Please, like an embargo is like, okay, everyone is going to try to publish it this time or sometime after. That's like the general agreement we'll go to, but certainly not content of our reviews, not like avoiding certain topics.
Also, the leader of Game Science has, I don't know, he's just a poster. Like, imagine this most whacked out stuff that Elon Musk has been posting about recently. This comes back to the idea of, are gamers okay?
Gamers like, are not okay.
I don't even want to mention it. It's just like kind of nasty, like fratty culture, you know, in a Chinese design studio, which makes me think, oh man, are all gamers the same? That's kind of sad.
I think a lot, it's in, especially studios that mostly consist of dudes in an industry that is very dude heavy, like unfortunately it leans to that. There is great reporting over at IGN last year. It's called How Black Myth Wukong Developers' History of Sexism is Complicating Its Journey to the West, written by Rebecca Valentine and Ki-Hoon Chan. This is a good piece, worth reading, because, yeah, essentially the culture of the studio does not seem great. It seems very, very fratty, very much like a boys' club. I will tell you all this. I'm 10 hours into this game, and now I do feel guilty about like playing it because I did not realize how fully shitty they were.
Yeah.
But not a single woman. 10 hours of me playing this game, talking to other creatures, talking to gods, talking to like, you know, other people I'm fighting or people like living on the mountain. Not a single female character.
Lore question for Shilin.
Yeah. Go.
I'm sure that's what you're about to ask, Ben, but just let me just tell you, the story itself is heavily male dominant, right? The story of the journey to the West is this Monkey King, this monk, and like his three disciples, including the Monkey King. So there's a pig boy,
Zhu Bajie,
and Tan San Zhang is the monk. And then he has like a dude with the burly facial hair that's one of his disciples. And then the Monkey King is like the second disciple, right? Or the third. And along the way, they go all the way to the West to like retrieve something. I forget what. the key point of the whole entire story, and I forget. But along the way, they encounter demons and, you know, things that are meant to, like, they want to eat the monk's flesh, basically, because it will give them immortality or something. And they're demons and they're lesser beings in the lore, right? So two of the demons that they encounter, or three, the spider demon and the nine-tailed fox, or the fox demon or whatever, Zhizhu Jing and Huni Jing, these are both women.
I've not encountered these characters yet, so I don't know.
So probably you have encountered them because they might be like bigger like enemies to fight. But I also will point out that in the historic telling of the story, that these two are known to seduce the Monkey King and the monk, their attempt to. And it's very sexualized that way. And also, like, it kind of filtered out into like slang. I wouldn't say slang, but like the vernacular, where in Mandarin, the words Zhizhu Jing spider demon or Huli Jing fox demon mean women who are like, I don't want to use the S word, but you know what I mean. Like, they're a little promiscuous, or they're a little more out there.
So you're
right?
saying like and the story itself is like inherently sexist too?
Yes.
Yeah. I am not surprised. Not at all surprised. But it does seem like the game is reflecting that. Listen, I think a modern developer could be like, well, screw that, right? Like, we could change things up because we are retelling the story.
Could be. It would have been so cool.
Would have been so cool.
But it is also China.
It is also China.
Where, like you mentioned, those stipulations, and in media and in entertainment, they're very careful about the messaging, which is why I was like nodding along when you said those things that they've stipulated, because it tracks.
It tracks. Anyway, game is okay. so far. Like, I'm enjoying it at least, but it does suck that this company has a history of this. I feel like this is like something, if they cared at all, just a thing they could have noted, but no, it doesn't seem like they care at all. Also, rewatching original Dragon Ball, you learn pretty much that Bulma is the goat. Nothing would happen in Goku's story without Bulma. So shout out to Bulma. My daughter Sophia loves Bulma. She's like, Bulma has all these like capsules. She's got all these vehicles. She's cool. Bulma is super cool. Shout out to Bulma. Okay, so that's Gamescom. Go take a look at all of our coverage from that event. And Am, if you're playing Black Myth Wukong, let me know what you think. Let's move on to some other news real quick. A couple things I wanted to shout out. I wrote up something that is so deeply nerdy, but I'm very proud that we put it on the site because, like, this is Engadget, okay? X-Memes, the company that Billy Steele has written about, which has produced solid state drivers for earbuds and things like that. So not like traditional speakers with like the coil and the magnet, all that stuff. Solid state, silicon that can work as your earbud driver. This company has used that same technology to produce a 1 millimeter tall fan on a chip. So this is 1 millimeter tall, essentially a chip that can work as a fan. It's using like ultrasonics to move air around within it.
Oh,
so
that's really interesting.
It's really
Isn't
cool.
Isn't that crazy?
So the whole idea is like,
because I was wondering, like, where are the moving parts?
Where are the moving
parts? Is the fan blade really, really tiny?
Ultrasonics, Ben. Ultrasonics. So Damn. Anyway, this company, and they're using MEMS technology, which is micro electromechanical systems technology. That is essentially like really, really, really small machinery, but in this case, with no moving parts. But essentially, like, you could put one or two or a couple of these fans inside a future smartphone, inside a tablet, inside a device like the MacBook Air M2, which died on me at Apple's campus because I was working in the sun, and that computer has no fan. So when you have no fan, the heat from all your work is just kind of trapped in there. So I just think this is really cool. This is something that could end up being in devices in the future, could really change the way like ultra thin devices are made. Like, if the rumors about Apple wanting to do that crazy ultra thin iPhone are true, like, maybe we got to get some airflow in that. And I just think that idea is just think it's neat. What do you guys think?
I really hope that this doesn't drive dogs crazy.
It's they say,
I mean,
it's silent,
ultrasonic. Yeah, so it has to be like way outside of the hearing range of like any creature. Hopefully.
It could. Sherlyn, thoughts?
I mean, I think the technology, the idea itself is really cool. I think fan on a chip, like just that alone, like we were all like, Devendra, you gotta like look at this one. And then you were like, yes, hell yes. Yeah. Like, it's just like, I think we all nerded out like a group, nerded out about this.
Good nerd stuff. I do want to point out there is like a competing product for, I hate saying it out loud, Frore. They are producing the Airjet Mini, which I believe The Verge and other sites have covered. And Frore's thing is 2.5 millimeters to 2.8 millimeters thick. So, you know, a couple millimeters taller. And it also looks like a bigger package in this thing. Like, the thing about XMEMS technology, it looks like a tiny little chip. So it could easily go inside your iPhone where there's this little space on real estate. It's the sort of thing you could put it right on the GPU, right on the APU. Looks cool, could change the way our devices are designed. So check out my coverage of the XMEMS chip. We wrote a story, San Francisco, real quick, is aiming to take down AI undressing websites in a new lawsuit. This is just good news because the fact that there is a prevalence of these apps, both on the web and in app stores, is absolutely disgusting. And we are like fully unequipped to deal with them right now. So this is a good thing. Hopefully we see more of this on a federal level too, not just San Francisco. And something I wanted to ask Sherlyn, because we saw this news drop, Chick-fil-A, the chicken sandwich place, is launching a streaming service for reality TV and its own programming. What do you think of Chick-fil-A's streaming service?
Okay, first of all,
yeah, I'm not joking.
Should have paid better attention to our show notes.
Yes, you should. Or not.
That's actually great.
Yeah.
That's really funny that you weren't aware of this, because now we're getting your real reaction.
Yeah, what are your first impressions on this news?
This is my first impression. Why? What are they going to show me?
It feels to me like these executives are like channeling an idea. Like they took out a Ouija board, but instead of communicating with spirits, they're communicating with the spirit of like 2015. And they're like, okay, what is the best business logic for growing our national company? Seen? Let's just do a streaming service because streaming services are really hot, right? No, dude, they're all consolidating because the Piper has asked to be paid in terms of streaming.
There's a paradise in the chat. It's like, are the cows the producers cut? Is CUD is like chicken dating show? I'm sorry. If this is the actual content we're expecting, hell yes.
I mean, Animal Planet has like puppy football. Like we have a lot of
why not?
Yeah. Yeah, instead of Love Island, it could be Love Pasture.
Listen. If they do like chicken farm content and then they slaughter the chickens and fry them, I think that is kind of concerning. But I will also say that have y'all seen the KFC like Hallmark movie?
I've not seen it. I know it exists.
Oh my god, yeah. Where Mario Lopez plays Colonel Sanders, yes, and then he falls in love with a woman.
I think maybe that's that was their funny inspiration. Like we gotta out chicken so KFC. We gotta do something.
It was
here
so good. I'm sorry if I've gone ultrasonic in my like pitch.
I think Chick-fil-A is flying too close to the sun. I think that's what it is. Like they are doing really well and just got all this money. Gonna do all this stuff.
Also, like Chick-fil-A is notorious for like, you know, did a cow write this sign? It's like EET more chicken.
Yeah.
Like all spelled wrong.
It's quite
so
funny.
I can only imagine what the closed captions would look like.
Oh man. but also Chick-fil-A is notoriously a like a very religiously leading company.
Yes, that's
too,
what
so
I was thinking too. Yeah.
Again, the Hallmark movie may actually be a good comparison.
Maybe?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's what I was thinking about. Yeah. It could be kind of like Hallmark or it could be like
what if we had our own Hallmark? Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, but like what if they bought Farmers Only, which I don't know if y'all know is like a Farmers Only dating website.
Yeah.
And then they were like chicken farmers only. And then they put them on a show.
Okay. So we had funny news. How about some WTF news? Because this is a crazy story and I'm just bringing it up because it is freaking wild. It's also basically the plot of Industry Season 3. British billionaire Mike Lynch was recently found dead after his yacht sank several days ago, or it may have been a week ago at this point. I'm mentioning this because this guy is involved in a lot of shady stuff. Like back when I was covering HP and startups and stuff, he was the CEO of Autonomy, and HP bought that for $11 billion. And not too long after, HP was like, oh, crap, we made a huge mistake. $8.8 billion write down just for buying Autonomy. He and his former VP of finance were basically like, I believe San Francisco was charging them for a while. They were recently acquitted in June. He was acquitted on 15 counts of fraud. This is a guy was just a bonkers life. So he disappeared from his boat, now proven to be dead. We think, oh, this is a kind of a weird story, right? His former VP of finance, Stephen Chamberlain, died mysteriously this week after being hit by a car.
Extremely mysterious.
Extremely like bank who's very pissed off about the billions of dollars that they probably lost because of your deal or your business practices. Extremely like, oh, we're going to make you go bye-bye now. Anyway, that is purely conjecture, purely conspiracy theory.
Yeah, but remember that episode of Breaking Bad where they coordinated a hit on like five different possible witnesses in different prisons all in the same 5 minutes?
Yeah. I mean, it is wild. Like there are some things that happen in real life that is totally freaky. I don't know. There are reports about what like ExxonMobil does to reporters. Like when they go cover oil fields or stuff somewhere, reporters have said like, my hotel reservation was canceled. Things are just really weird, like weird shit that these companies have the power to do, folks. Like, we see stories about the mobs and stuff, but don't forget who has all the money and all the power. Just dropping that weird story right there. Anyway, watch Industry if you want another angle or another type of story like this. Sherlyn, again, you should watch that show. I think you'd enjoy it.
I just want to point out that Devendra, I you know me, I like to rewatch Schitt's Creek until the day I die before I even start a new show. So,
well, it's more like you want some nice drama, nice steamy drama in
when
your
I
life.
When I do want some nice non-science fiction
drama.
Non-science
fiction drama with like human characters who have flaws, who are very ambitious. Like, I think you would...
Doesn't that sound like this other show, this Succession?
It's very... In fact, I wrote a whole piece about that, Sherlyn, so you should go read that review. Flying Lotus, the artist, one of my favorite artists, has confirmed that he composed two Apple ringtones, Daybreak and Chalet, which have been on iPhone since 2019. So I'm just, that's cool. It's cool to me. Is it cool to you, Ben?
Must have been a nice bag. Must have been a really nice bag. And this is also has like a podcast connection because the podcast 20,000 Hertz, which is a podcast all about sound design. So they were doing a little series called The Sound of Apple, and they talked about it. And so now Flying Lotus was like, okay, I didn't just ghost produce these. I can say, yes, I produced these two ringtones, and I'll drop these two ringtones in on the audio version. So here's Daybreak. And here's Chalet.
That's super cool. I've switched back to Daybreak, but they have the same like layers and vibes of like Flying Lotus and stuff. So I'm like, okay, we should probably told that. This is like the rumors about Michael Jackson working on the Sonic 3 soundtrack. This is like that level of like geek and artistry kind of combining, which I don't think was ever fully confirmed. Like maybe he did some consulting or something, but that soundtrack did slap. So there's that. Let's move on to some pop culture picks for the week. What do you got, Sherlyn?
So when I thought I had pop culture picks this week, I realized I might have already shared it with this podcast. Just a reminder that I still watch Scary Interesting Till I Die because it's hilarious. I mean, hilariously morbid. it's just hilarious that I listen to those stories of people getting stuck in caves and underwater diving accidents.
Why would you do this to yourself? Okay.
Because I enjoy it somehow. So I think I have mentioned this right on the podcast. I think Ben or Dev, you might remember, Scary Interesting, like cave exploring gone wrong. Anyway, so instead of that sort of pop culture pick, I'm going to give you all a different one, which is I recently discovered, because it surfaced on my app, YouTube has these games now. Have y'all seen these?
I'm aware that they're games.
Yeah. So it's not like new information. It's not brand new information, as Phoebe Buffay would say. But I just started playing some of them, and they're quite hilariously not great, but also somewhat addictive in classic me.
Classic Sherlyn. Like, yes. Classic airplane, the game included on the airplane TV. Sherlyn, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
There is a game that I've been playing on YouTube Games called Phone Case Designer.
Okay. Yeah.
That's my recommendation.
Thank you for that, Sherlyn. Actually, Ben, do you want to shout anything out? Because I need to run to the bathroom right now, I think. So, Ben.
Okay, go for
give
it.
Give us something we'll and you guys wrap the thing. I'll be right
back. Yeah. I get to do a producer pick. That's cool. Okay, so a couple of years ago, there was a book that came out called Uncanny Valley by Anna Weiner or Wiener. I think it might be Weiner. And it's generally like a story that I am very familiar with, which is like, this is a nonfiction book. It's about a woman's experience going from the publishing world to working in startups in the early 2010s. She started out working for this like big data company when big data was first rising, and then like moved over to GitHub, and is just talking about her personal experience with the weird culture of the Bay Area during that time. Because in that time of like the early to mid 2010s was when like the population of the Bay Area, especially like San Francisco, Oakland area, was really turning over. There were a lot of people, a lot of young professionals coming from all over the country to work at these startups, making a lot of money, like talking about doing ayahuasca trips and how even when they're tripping, they're thinking about like B2B business solutions. It's strange. It's not something that I wasn't already aware of, but it's just fun to listen to. I'm listening to the audiobook.
I mean, that's why we all do the pop culture picks from different people, because different people have different tastes, and you have your taste, and I love to play silly little YouTube games. So there you go. Simon B in the chat says YouTube games are too addicting. So I feel like I feel supported.
Where were you back in the Facebook games era, Sherlyn? Like, were you
Candy Crush? Were you deep in Farmville or not?
Yeah.
PVZ? No, I didn't play Farmville, even though I think I could have. And I think a lot of people in my circles did play them. Mm-hmm. Feels like a...
Okay.
Okay, anyway. So Dev, do you have a pick?
Yeah, I'll do real quick. I do want to shout out that one of the greatest TV shows ever made, which has been inaccessible for a long time, Homicide: Life on the Street. One of the best cop shows ever made. It's now streaming.
Wire Before the Wire.
Wire Before the Wire, based on David Simon's book, with a lot of people who went on to produce other TV shows like Bosch. It is now streaming on Peacock. It's an incredible show starring the late, great Andre Brower. So you miss Andre Brower from Brooklyn Nine-Nine. A lot of great actors, like characters that were established in Homicide, went on to Law & Order and other things. So it's a fantastic show. You should check it out, especially the first few seasons. It's streaming right now. I have the DVD set, which was just on sale, but I'm still happy to have that, because I feel like the digital version can go any time. You gotta buy the things you love. So that's what I've got for this week.
Well, that's it for the episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Dev or Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter, Blue Sky, Mastodon, the usual places. And I chat about movies and TV at The Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
If you want to hit me up, I am occasionally on Twitter still. I am at Sherlynlow there, Sherlynlow. But you can hit me up on Threads, where I am posting engagement bait at Sherlynnstagram. Always email us your thoughts about this podcast at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes or whatever you're getting your podcast on, because that helps people discover us, and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts.
Were you deep in Farmville or not?